All right, Jonathan, I didn't check with you. Are you ready to go with this second set of PowerPoints?
Yes.
How could I have ever doubted? Look, guys, when we get through, you hug Jonathan and his brother because they're good. You can't do this without the IT guys, period. I think you can see this kind of a lesson depends utterly on the material that you see before you. At least you're going to be effective. So thank you for staying for another hour of this. And at the end of this time, we'll have some Q&A if you'd like, and we'll try to answer some questions that maybe we are able to answer. And if not, we'll tell you where you might go to look. But thank you for staying, and I don't want to take any more time except to get right into the second example of poor design argument, the human eye. And I almost see looks of utter unbelief that someone could criticize the human eye as a poor design. Well, that's because you haven't studied it. I'm going to introduce you to it. So first we're going to start with the same passage, Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, which says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and his Godhead, so that they are without excuse." The Bible teaches observation of nature can lead you to believe in God. And it's the argument from design. That's what we're doing in every one of these lessons. So, but we're not using this book, right? I mean, you've gotten used to this. We are turning now to God's other book, which, by the way, class, I want to tell you, I have no problem whatsoever with not bringing a Bible into a biology or a chemistry classroom. In fact, I think it's inappropriate because the Bible is a direct revelation from God, and I firmly believe that's what it is, but it is not the way science works. Science is observing nature and trying to draw conclusions from that. It's not saying, well, God told me this, and therefore I believe it. I mean, that's okay, but that's not the way science works. Are you with me? And may I just add another point about that? Did you watch the debate between Bill Nye, the science guy, and who was the creationist? I forgot. Ken Ham, some years ago. I lasted about 10 minutes in that debate. And here's why. And please, this is my opinion. They were like this. Ken Ham's approach to teaching creation is the Bible is true, it's right, and whatever the Bible says is right, and it agrees with science. I mean, science agrees with it. That's his approach. I don't have any criticism of that approach, except when I'm debating a person that doesn't even believe in God. Why would you use the Bible as your starting place when the person doesn't even believe in God? And by the way, you don't need to use the Bible. Use the same ground on which he walks. Use science and show him from science that he is not interpreting it correctly. That's not what they were doing in that debate. And in my view, it was an utter waste of time. My opinion. And you say, that's easy to do because you weren't in the debate. Well, you're right. But I have had a debate
with a evolutionists some years ago, and it was a totally different approach than Ken Ham used. And it's one I would recommend to you. And here's the reason. God has given us sufficient evidence in the natural world to support belief in God. And in every generation, there was enough evidence in the natural world to convince that generation. When David wrote Psalm 19, he didn't know one thing about spliceosomes. Okay, but he knew enough from his time to know there's got to be a God that developed this. In our time, we need more, I think, because we're being bombarded with lots of information. They say prove otherwise, which is why I'm doing this series. And you young people are part of my scope because you're being bombarded from all sides. And you too. There are folks all over this audience. In fact, all of us are. All right, that was thrown in free of charge. But I felt like I needed to say something about that. So we're going to start with Dr. Jerry Coyne. He's a hardline evolutionist, and he wrote a book called Why Evolution is True. Does that give you a hint? 2009. Here's what he said. Perfect design would truly be the sign of a skilled and intelligent designer. Imperfect design is the mark of evolution. In fact, it is precisely what we expect from evolution. The leftovers of a junky past, where nature just did stuff without any purpose and it left stuff behind that shows it was an evolutionary process. Jerry Coyne. Here's what I would say to you, class. Complexity can only come two ways. The evolutionist says, the ultimate reductionist, that complex organs or systems arose from simpler things in small steps by natural causes. That's the position. Small steps by natural causes. The creationist says complex organs could not have arisen without intelligent design. There are no other answers. And may I say to you, class, that in universities and in K through 12 classrooms in our country, the second option is forbidden in science classrooms. I think I could win a debate if you can only have one answer. But that's where we are. And that is not good science. But understand, please, you cannot investigate God with science because he's not a material being. Are you listening? But does that mean you cannot investigate science for evidence of intelligent design? No, it does not mean that. You certainly can do that. And there's powerful evidence to support somebody designed this. But if you want to know more about that being other than what nature can tell you, you got to go to this book. And that's another subject. All right. So here's what Darwin said on complex organs. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Darwin on the Origin of Species. I'm pausing. I want you to catch that. It's only the undergirding for this whole lecture. His position, and you know why I like Darwin? Because half of his book is critiquing his own theory. He goes through and says, this is a problem for my theory, and then he tries to answer it. But who does that? Well, he did, and I appreciate that. I think that's a sign of a man who's at least an honest searcher. So in this book, Origin of Species, he said this on page 219 in my version. If you could show me one complex organ that could not have been formed, I want to do it again. Numerous, successive, slight modifications. Listen, Darwin would tell you, nature doesn't take leaps. You don't have an egg, a bird laying an egg, and out comes an elephant. No. You have small changes over long periods of time that add up, so that single-celled organisms could eventually produce all the living things you see, including you. But if you can't do it by successive, slight, numerous steps, then my theory is dead. And I have an opinion. If Darwin lived today and he saw the complexity of the things I've tried to show you, I think he never would have come up with his theory. At least not to the extent that it's been proposed. I would recommend the human eye as a good example of a complex organ that could not have come about by small steps over long periods of time. I happen to believe there are lots of them. And the one I'd recommend from last night's lecture, I hope you all know, is the bacterial flagellum. Because in that case, not only do you have to figure out how the flagellum got there, that little thing that wraps, and the motor that drives it, but but how did the cell learn to build it? So not only do you have to have a Ford, you got to have the factory to build a Ford, made by nature itself. Small steps over long periods of time. Look, Ford has a hard enough time getting all the things together in its factories with intelligent design. What about the human eye? It scared Darwin to death. So he says in his book, to suppose, may I do it in the British accent? To suppose that the eye, with all of its inimitable contrivances, for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberrations, could have been formed by natural selection, seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree. And I say, amen. And that's in his book. Whereupon he proceeds to tell how, in fact, it did happen. Yet reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a perfect and complex eye to one very imperfect and simple, each grade being useful to its possessor, can be shown to exist. Now I want to walk this through with you. Point number one Darwin makes. Is it true there are all kinds of eyes in nature? Nod your head. Or do this if you disagree. I think you'd agree, wouldn't you? Second, if further the eye does vary ever so slightly, would you agree? I'm wearing these. Some of you are not. Do eyes vary? Well, they certainly do. Nature presents you with variation. Third, he says, and the variations be inherited, which is certainly the case. Thank you, Mom and Dad. Right? You'd agree, wouldn't you? And if any variation or modification in the organ be ever useful to an animal under changing conditions of life, are some changes useful? Well, I think you'd have to agree that some changes are useful. Can I give you one from disease? We have invented medicines to kill certain kinds of diseases, right? Penicillin, for one. Did you know the little creatures that would be killed by penicillin evolved to the point that they had creatures that couldn't be killed by penicillin? Was that good for the creature? Wasn't good for you. But was it good for the creature who now survived? Folks, there are things that happen in nature that are mutations, that are changes, that are useful once in a while. So I would have to say Darwin is correct that that happens once in a while. It's rare. Then he says, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, can hardly be considered real. And that was his story. And may I say to you, that's all it is a story. It is not an explanation. And people believed it. It's another fairy tale. But it was sufficiently convincing to explain how the human eye got here. Okay, are you ready back there for the next slide? Here's what I want to do next, class. And I don't want anybody sleeping. I want to show you a TED Talk that is commonly shown in public schools, science classrooms, to kids and to adults, that explains what we now say today about how your eye evolved. It's a TED Talk. And I'm going to let it play without interruption, I hope. It's really hard for me to sit and watch this. I want to stand up and shout. But I want you to watch for the brazen statements that are made in this thing. First of all, how close it is to what Darwin argued. It's the same argument. And second, how brazenly they state that this is what happened. This is what we get all the time. And then when he's done, I'm going to rip it to shreds. But I first want you to listen as if you were sitting in a biology class and this is what your professor showed you. So, are we ready?
and it got the sound. This one I'm allowing sound. Let me sit by. We need sound. And we need it to work. You going to start again?
I'm going to try to.
All right.
The human eye is an amazing mechanism, able to detect anywhere from a few photons to direct sunlight, or switch focus from the screen in front of you to the distant horizon in a third of a second. In fact, the structures required for such incredible flexibility were once considered so complex that Charles Darwin himself acknowledged that the idea of their having evolved seemed absurd in the highest possible degree. And yet, that is exactly what happened, starting more than 500 million years ago. The story of the human eye begins with a simple light spot, such as the one found in single-celled organisms, like euglena. This is a cluster of light-sensitive proteins linked to the organism's flagellum, activating when it finds light, and therefore, food. A more complex version of this light spot can be found in the flatworm Planaria. Being cupped rather than flat enables it to better sense the direction of incoming light. Among its other uses, this ability allows an organism to seek out shade and hide from predators. Over the millennia, as such light cups grew deeper in some organisms, the opening at the front grew smaller. The result was a pinhole effect, which increased resolution dramatically, reducing distortion by only allowing a thin beam of light into the eye. The Nautilus, an ancestor of the octopus, uses this pinhole eye for improved resolution and directional sensing. Although the pinhole eye allows for simple images, the key step towards the eye as we know it is a lens. This is thought to have evolved through transparent cells covering the opening to prevent infection, allowing the inside of the eye to fill with fluid that optimizes light sensitivity and processing. Crystalline proteins forming at the surface created a structure that proved useful in focusing light at a single point on the retina. It is this lens that is the key to the eye's adaptability, changing its curvature to adapt to near and far vision. This structure of the pinhole camera with a lens served as the basis for what would eventually evolve into the human eye. Further refinements would include a colored ring called the iris that controls the amount of light entering the eye. A tough white outer layer known as the sclera to maintain its structure, and tear glands that secrete a protective film. But equally important was the accompanying evolution of the brain, with its expansion of the visual cortex to process the sharper and more colorful images it was receiving. We now know that far from being an ideal masterpiece of design, our eye bears traces of its step-by-step evolution. For example, the human retina is inverted, with light-detecting cells facing away from the eye opening. This results in a blind spot where the optic nerve must pierce the retina to reach the photosensitive layer in the back. The similar-looking eyes of cephalopods, which evolved independently, have a front-facing retina, allowing them to see without a blind spot. Other creatures' eyes display different adaptations. Anableps, the so-called four-eyed fish, have eyes divided in two sections for looking above and underwater, perfect for spotting both predators and prey. Cats, classically nighttime hunters, have evolved with a reflective layer maximizing the amount of light the eye can detect, granting them excellent night vision, as well as their signature glow. These are just a few examples of the huge diversity of eyes in the animal kingdom. So if you could design an eye, would you do it any differently? This question isn't as strange as it might sound. Today, doctors and scientists are looking at different eye structures to help design biomechanical implants for the vision impaired. And in the not not-so-distant future, the machines built with the precision and flexibility of the human eye may even enable it to surpass its own evolution.
You see what I mean? If you finish that as a young child, you'd think we've got it all figured out. Over 500 million years through the various stages of types of eyes, we eventually have our eyes that now are able to do what they do. It's a solved problem, class. Everything about that needs to be examined. And it is not in many classrooms. So you leave there thinking, did you notice he slipped in the little notion that, by the way, there's some leftovers from your evolutionary past in the human eye, as if that's all settled? And then he talked about the various kinds of eyes as if one somehow leads to the other. And then he talks about, let me stop there. Who says the simple light-sensitive spot in a euglena is a precursor to our eyes? Who says that? Darwin said that. That's the authority. There's no evidence for that. In fact, class, if you went in and studied the chemistry of the light-sensitive spot in a euglena, you would find an amazingly complex set of chemical equations that are so massive, even to have a light-sensitive spot without a creator is beyond belief. And I have a whole lecture on light-sensitive spots. Because the chemistry is incredible. And it builds on itself. I mean, that was designed. And did you notice that he said the octopus eye evolved independently? Wait a minute. I thought you were lining up these eyes to lead to one another. And then he talked about all the different kinds of eyes we found in nature. Look, folks, their ultimate position on this is that all those eyes evolved separately. You talk about an unbelievable something. And yet they'll use them to show there's a pattern leading up to our eyes. And then they'll take a poke at why it's not designed well. So here's a book called Human Errors by Nathan H. Lentz. And the subtitle is A Panorama of Our Glitches from Pointless Bones to Broken Genes. And included in Nathan Lentz's diatribe is the human eye as an example of a poor design. So my goal for the rest of this hour, besides getting really upset with that TED Talk, is to show you the truth about the human eye. So here we go. You see, I would say, as would Richard Dawkins, no, pardon me, Michael Behe in this good little book. There's a good treatment of this in Behe's book. Get the latest version. It's 10 years after the first one. And he says the case for evolution is 10 years worse than it was before. Don't talk to me about eyes at the macro level where you can see them. Talk to me about the chemistry down inside. Explain to me how that evolved, and then we can talk. I want to talk about biochemistry. So here we go. This is a human eye, and you can see it up here, lots of different parts. The cornea and the lens and the iris, and he talked about those, the vitreous body, and of course the retina's here at the back, and the sclera's behind it, and the choroid is right there. See that choroid right here? We're going to talk about all of that briefly. Most of that was known in Darwin's day because they had dissected lots of eyeballs. So they knew most of that. What they didn't know was this.
This is a blow up of the neural layer of the human retina, magnification. And here's another magnification of that same area. This is light from the outside coming in. And here are the various types of cells. There's the Müller cell, the ganglion neurons, the dipolar neurons. You've got the rods and the cones up here and the pigmental epithelium up there. But class, we can blow this up now and see it. That's just that little thin layer of the retina. And so in Nathan Lentz's book that I mentioned to you, he speaks of this thing as being poorly designed. I want to show you why. Here's that layer I just showed you. The light comes in from here. Right here is the optic nerve. Well, why, he said, would you put the optic nerve blocking the light or in the way of the light, which has got to come through here, reach all the way up to the rods and cones where it is received and processed, and then the signal is sent back down here to the optic nerve, which then sends it on to the brain. Why would you do that? It's wired backwards. That's the argument. So let's see what some folks said. Here's our favorite author, Richard Dawkins. Any engineer would naturally assume that the photocells would point towards the light with their wires leading backwards toward the brain. He would laugh at any suggestion that the photocells might point away from the light with their wires departing on the side nearest the light. Yet that is exactly what happens in all vertebrate retinas. I go on. Each photocell is in effect wired backwards. With its wire sticking out on the side nearest the light, the wire has to travel over the surface of the retina to a point where it dives through a hole in the retina, that is the so-called blind spot, to join the optic nerve. It is the principle of the thing that would offend any tidy-minded engineer. And so Mr. Dawkins would say, in his British accent, I know better than God. If this is what God did. Because it's wired backwards. Do you get a little tired of the cockiness? I don't want to be that way. But I want to be firm. Because they're not telling you the truth. So here's a picture that came out of Lentz's book. Let's look at it. Get over here. Here's the vertebrate eye. Do you see that there's a blind spot right there? Because look, the nerves are in front of the retina. See that? These are the nerves. And then the nerves plow through. That's a blind spot because they got to plow through and go to the optic nerve. And by the way, I forgot to say this about that ridiculous TED Talk. Did you notice how it just blithely stated that the brain evolved at the same time with a special cortex region to receive the signals? It just evolved at the same time. The brain is only the most complex thing in humanity and in the universe. And it just evolved so that it had a cortex that received signals from the eye and translated into three-dimensional color. Small steps over millions of years. That's how that happened, class. Well, the eye got messed up, he says, because it's got the nerves in front of the retina. You wouldn't do that if you were an engineer, whereas a cephalopod is the exact opposite. See, the retina's on the outside, and the nerves are in behind it, and then it runs off. So the cephalopod evolved better than we did. So your eyes are wired backwards. That's poor design, so it wasn't God doing it. That's the argument. Now, do you know how to answer that? I don't think so. Not unless you've studied this. And I don't know all the answers either. But I know a whole lot more than we knew 20 or 30 years ago. And this kind of stuff that's thrown at you, class, I'm going to just say again. This kind of stuff that's thrown at you by intelligent people who are your professors and I've had it over and over again, and you don't know what to do about it, can be faith destroying. Don't let it do it. Give it a little while and keep studying. There would be no blind spot if the vertebrate eye were really intelligently designed. In fact, it is stupidly designed, while the retina of a squid is right side up, says George Williams in his book, Natural Selection, Domains, Levels, and Challenges, 1992. So George Williams says it's stupidly designed. I wish I could get George Williams up here today and show him a few things since 1992. And do you think he would apologize for making such a ridiculous statement? Don't hold your breath. Is the human eye really evidence against intelligent design? Good question. Article by Jonathan Wells in Evolution News and lots of other places. So let me try to explain to you a few things. Let me see what's next here. Yeah, we're going to point out some of the pieces. Back here is the network of capillaries called the epithelium at the back. Let's see if we've got something else next. That's the retinal epithelium. Yeah, that's, I'm wrong. This is the capillaries. That's the choriac. This is the retinal pigment epithelium right here. And this is the Müller glia cells. Do you see that cell right there that starts back here and goes all the way through? We're coming back to that in a minute. The light comes in from over here. It goes through all of this. It's picked up by the rods and cones. And then the signal sent back through the nerve cells and goes to the outside and then out to the brain. That's the layout. Having the photoreceptors at the back of the retina is not a design constraint. It is a design feature, says John Hewitt in his article, Fiber Optic-Like Pipes in the Retina. That was published in 2014. Did you hear what he said there, class? Not only is it not a bad design, it's a design feature. The idea that the vertebrate eye might have been improved somehow if it had only been able to orient its wiring behind the photoreceptor layer like the cephalopod is folly. Real eyes are much more crafty than that. May I just pause here a moment and say, cephalopods live in an entirely different environment than you and I do. And the needs for eyes in that environment are different than their needs for eyes in our environment. So the very fact they're comparing the two and trying to make some big deal out of that is a problem. But this man says, having studied it rather carefully, there's some nice design features about the way your eyes, and by the way, they're better than cephalopods. I don't want to hear it. Let's have a contest. Of course you can't. A case in point are the Müller glia cells that span the thickness of the retina. I wish I could get this across to you properly. I'm going to try. I pointed out the Müller glia cells. Remember these? They're right here. They start down here where the light comes in, and they spread across the entire length here. See them? What we've learned about those Müller glia cells is that they do amazing things. So watch. Müller cells in the retina assume the role of optical fibers and reliably transfer light with a low scattering from the retinal surface to the photoreceptor cell layer. Thus, this finding elucidates a fundamental feature of the inverted retina as an optical system. Those Müller cells, class, and you see the picture over here? I love that picture. That's a drawing. When the light comes in out here, the Müller cells transport them through all that mess down here without letting them disperse, and down here they spread out the light among the rods and the cones effectively to where the red and the green and the purple and the violet need to be. So it's like an optical fiber system that reliably transfers the light across that medium.
And it makes it more effective because in the process, all that time that it takes to do that, it's already starting to process the light before it ever sends it to the brain. Kind of neat. I'm letting you just look at that picture. I love it. I want you to remember Müller glia cells in your eyes. Not only is this not a poor design, it's a more effective design to let light get where it needs to be and disperse it properly. So, may I offer my apology again? I think I've done that 3 or 4 times. That is a totally incomplete and insufficient explanation of how your eyes work better than anybody ever dreamed. But I'm telling you, the blatant statements by Lentz and lots of other folks about how if it's a stupid design are stupid. But that's not even the beginning of the story. Because what we've learned is how light functions inside there to let you see in the first place. And that's what I want to talk to you about for the next few minutes. Okay, let's go back to that one. Here you have a blow-up of a human rod cell, which is where the action takes place on part of it. And you see this little piece of that human rod cell? The rod cell's kind of long, but here's one piece of it, and we're blowing that up. That's what this is. This is the magnification of that piece of the human rod cell, which is at the top, you remember? And here it is. And here you see all these discs that contain rhodopsin. You can see the microtubules. You can see the mitochondria. This is a normal cell. It has all the different parts. It's just expanded. But here's where the action takes place, in these discs. So now, you see that little piece right there? That's blown up to make this. And this, of course, is an animation. It's a picture of that disc, that set of discs right there. Here's a disc membrane. And here's the plasma membrane running along here. And what we're going to look at now, class, is down inside that rod cell, what is the chemistry like? Okay, you ready? Anybody sleepy? I'm looking. All right. I need your attention right now because we're doing chemistry. Only the most important thing you'll ever do. Here we go. All right, here's a drawing of those same things, and here's the chemistry. And to make sure we get this right, I'm going to turn here to a page in Michael Behe's book. That describes the chemistry. And I'm going to come down here. I'm tired of turning around, almost falling off. All right, here we go. Can you see okay? All right, we're going to start right here. That's rhodopsin. When a photon of light hits rhodopsin, listen closely. When light first strikes the retina, a photon interacts with the molecule 11-cis-retinal, which rearranges within picoseconds to transretinal. Picoseconds. How fast is that? It's the time it takes light to travel across the width of a hair. Way too slow. So what happens when light hits that rhodopsin, it changes its chemical structure from cis to trans. The change in the shape of the retinal molecule forces a change in the shape of the protein rhodopsin, to which the retinal is tightly bound. The protein's metamorphosis alters its behavior, and this now is called metarhodopsin 2. The protein sticks to another protein called transducin. See that one right? Whoops. Come back here. You see that one right there? Transducin. Gets stuck to this one now. Now it's called, before bumping into the metarhodopsin 2 transducin, it tightly bound a small molecule called GDP. But when the transducin interacts with metarhodopsin 2, the GDP falls off and the molecule GTP binds to the transducin. So you now have a GTP bound to this, which is bound to that. I know you're going to remember all this. I'm getting a point across. You don't have to remember all this.
When attached to the metarhodopsin 2 in entourage, the phosphodiesterate acquires the chemical ability to cut a molecule called cGMP. This guy gets the capacity to cut cGMP and make it 5-GMP. Why is that important? Because cGMP in this medium helps make an interchange of ions that allows you to see. Another membrane protein binds with cGMP is called an ion channel. See that over here? That's the channel right there. It lets ions in and out. It acts as a gateway that regulates the number of sodium ions in the cell. If the reactions mentioned above were the only ones that operated in the cell, because what happens is this decreases the amount of cGMP, which allows stuff to flow in. If that's all that happened, ladies and gentlemen, you'd be blind in 5 minutes. Because you'd run out of stuff. Something has to turn off the proteins that were turned on and restore the cell to its original state. Several mechanisms do this. First, in the dark ion channel, also lets calcium ions into the cell. The calcium is pumped back out by a different protein so that the constant calcium concentration is remained. When the cGMP levels fall, shutting down the ion channel, the calcium ion concentrate decreases too. The phosphodiesterate enzyme, which destroys the cGMP, slows down at a lower calcium concentration. Second, a protein called guanylate cyclase, right there, starts making GTP back into cGMP, and so you increase this again. So this reverse reaction takes place almost instantly to start restoring what you lost, and it's a constant like this. Third, while all of this is going on, metarhodopsin 2 is chemically modified by an enzyme called rhodopsin kinase, which helps it go back to its original state. There's about 10 different proteins involved there, class, that have a constant balance. And I would say to Charles Darwin or Nathan Lentz or anybody else who wants to talk about it, you explain to me how that evolved by small steps over long periods of time in millions of years to produce your eyes the way they function. I don't want to talk about eyeballs. You tell me how that chemistry got started. And then we can talk about something else. Here's another diagram. You got a forward reaction, and you got a reverse reaction, and you have to have a constant interplay of all of those. This one stimulates, this one inhibits, and you got to have it all, or you'd be blind. And it's all chemistry. That's why I like to say with Michael Behe, everywhere you look, you see design. And it's utterly amazing to me that Richard Dawkins would write a book called The Blind Watchmaker, in which he argues that everything you see around you that looks designed is not. Because natural selection, acting on natural variation, and the blind forces of physics are sufficient to account for all design that looks like it's designed, but it isn't. And it takes him 300 pages to try to explain that. And it's a fairy tale. And that's my lesson for this hour. I close with this biblical expression: the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. Proverbs 20. Thank you for staying. I mean, this has been a long morning. I'm sure you have other things to do on Saturday. And there's a lot of questions here. We'll see. But thank you for staying, and I'll do the best I can. This question says, is the rate of reactions in the eye chemistry at all related to the frame rate of the human eye? That is, it's able to detect 30 to 60 frames per second. And I don't know the direct answer to that question, but I suspect it has to be related, because you can't see without the chemistry that I showed you. So it has to be functioning very, very rapidly. But you know, folks, what we didn't talk about at all, and maybe there's a question about this, but the transfer of the signals from the light to an electrical signal through the nerve to the brain, which is then translated into 3D
vision is another incredible process we didn't even touch. And you're going to tell me that also evolved as the brain just somehow evolved at the same time with the exact right kind of a mechanism. I'm sorry. That is not believable. All right. With so many confident assertions by evolutionists influencing the world, what advice do you have, or how can we interact both boldly and humbly with friends and acquaintances who have been influenced to accept evolution? Well, one thing I would say, don't yell as much as I did. And by the way, when I'm teaching chemistry and math in a college setting, I don't yell like that. I do make my point forcefully, but I don't yell. And I don't call people stupid. Sorry. But he did, right? He said it was a stupid design. Anyway, I would say talk to your friends and try to direct them in things that you know. Please don't try to explain something you don't understand, because you're going to hurt the cause. Because you'll probably say something not very good. So point them to sources where they can learn. And I've got, Jonathan, don't let me forget, I'm going to give you the bibliography. He'll have a copy of that electronically. All you have to do is give him your email, and he'll send you that bibliography. And I have 3 and 4 stars by the really good stuff. And most of those books that have some heavy science in them are such that you can skip the really heavy part when you get lost and catch up and still get the point. So don't get scared. That's what I would do. I would help people go to sources that will help them see something they've never seen before, which is a good thing. The eye is wired to the back of the brain. Wouldn't evolution go against this and have it wired to the front? Do we know why it is wired this way? And my answer is, I don't know the answer to that one. But I do know this. The brain is much more complex than anything we've talked about this week. Way more. I would say the closest thing I'm aware of in the human body is the immune system. And we're talking about it in the morning for less than an hour. But the brain, it's the most complex organ that exists, I think. Certainly people argue that. But how it's constructed and why it's the way it is, I haven't done enough to answer that question. Our bodies, the bodies of animals, plants, and all living things we can observe, are copies of copies of copies stretching all the way back to Adam. Can you speak on the loss of genetic information over time and how that comes into the mapping and study of DNA? What about that vitamin C in humans versus rabbits? Okay, that's a big question right there. Of course, over time, particularly after sin entered the world, there's been a lot of degradation. Would you agree? A lot of degradation. In fact, there's been a lot of death. And one of the really interesting questions to me, and I know I'm getting off the subject a little bit here, but I want you to know I have questions I don't know how to answer. And this is a biblical type question. Adam and Eve in the garden. Were there little E. coli swimming around in their gut, dying regularly? I'm not going to answer it. I don't know. But typically our biome has that involved in it. And certainly at the cellular level, there was stuff going on that had to mean there were some, well, I mean, you told me you got 2 trillion cells dying and mitosing, right? So was that happening? That's just a question. But the point is, after Adam and Eve, I assume after they came out of the garden, there's been a lot of degradation. And folks, you don't understand how many mutations you've had. You've had a lot. Can you give us some idea of how many? No, probably not. It's a lot, though, isn't it? And listen, your chemistry inside your body and your organs and the various parts of you show evidence of having had mutation in the background. So don't deny that. That's happened. It's interesting that your body has provided enough of a help mechanism to repair some of that, to keep things going.
I guess a perspective would be, if you take E. coli, it can copy 1,000 nucleotides per second, makes an error of 1 million.
Did everybody hear that? He's talking about E. coli. Say that again.
It can copy information 1,000
Typically, there's an error of 1 in 1,000,000, and it copies 1 in 1,000,000,000. And how many does it make?
Per second.
When it's copying its information. So there are errors made. In addition to that, you should know, though, that built into your system, there are some corrections of mutational errors that are made automatically before it does anything to you. Did you know that? Built into your system? Sounds like a plan to me. But it is true there are mutations that take place naturally, and they do add up. So over generations of time, it does affect things. So I'm not sure what the questioner wanted to hear about that, but it's true. And then what about vitamin C in humans? I want you to read Myth Junk, the Junk DNA. There's an appendix just on vitamin C in which he explains what we understand about that supposed pseudogene right now. That'd be the best way to answer that question. Okay, where does the light come from for the light spot? On that euglena, I assume that's what you're talking about, the euglena, as it's flowing around through the water, there are light that can get through water, right? There are. And so it can react then to the light that hits that light-sensitive spot. And when it does, there's a chemistry that starts on that cell layer and down inside that eventually gets to, and this is the fun part, it goes through a series of reactions to reaches a point that there's a protein that activates something that tells that, what word am I wanting? The filament to rotate the opposite way. It's chemical, by folks, it's all chemistry. It gets down to the point where it activates that little whatever it is to make the filament, instead of rotating clockwise, rotate counterclockwise, which allows the euglena to move a different direction, either toward the light or away from it, depending on what it's doing for it. So the light is just natural light that comes in there, and it reacts to that. All right? The TED Talk explanation legitimately looks like it was made up on the spot. Well, what can I say? I'll tell you what, it has convinced a lot of people. Do people still use the poor design arguments now that DNA and the eyes are better understood? Are there other things they use today to argue for poor design? Does pigmentation affect sight processes? Wow. Okay, I would say to you, if you want to study anything else they're making about design arguments, get Nathan Lentz's book and read that to start with, because it's full of examples that he says are examples of poor design. Yes, it's still being used. Definitely is. And there are other examples besides the two I have selected. And you know I selected them because I know the most about those two, and I could explain what's wrong with what they're saying. There are a lot of others I haven't studied that deeply. But there's material out there. And one of the things, young people, I mean, I ask kids to find something, and in 3 seconds they found it. It makes me sick. I used to have to go through books. Now I go click, 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 there it is. In fact, the hard thing is to try to come up with a question they can't answer in 3 seconds. So you make them put away their electronics and think. Okay, I got to go side trip here. I'm a math teacher for a long time. I made my kids do the old way first before they're allowed to punch buttons. Just thrown in free of charge. Is sin and the consequences thereof the cause for the imperfections that atheists, evolutionists point to? In the creationist science books I was reading from last year, they talked about the science of the fall and bringing of destruction and death to the world. That's the best explanation I have from a biblical standpoint. In terms of the science standpoint, I argue that the second law of thermodynamics is a property of nature. And it leads to deterioration. It's offset by the energy law, and when there's a balance, then you got homeostasis. Sometimes it gets unbalanced, and that causes more deterioration. So there is a natural law that we've discovered that things deteriorate. That's the way nature is. From a biblical standpoint, I believe that entered when sin entered. At least somehow God managed that. Don't have a perfect answer for that. From the point of view that excludes intelligent design, are there any mechanisms other than mutations that generate new genetic information? Oh, yes. There's lots of different kinds of things that happen. And you just need to understand. I don't have time to explain it, but there are things in your genetic structure that end up being copied again, so you get duplicate copies of information inside. That happens. That's one way mutations take place. And then there are point mutations, there are section mutations, there are other kinds of things that take place. But in just in the chemistry itself, would you say when you have one mistake in a billion, that mistake was a chemical mistake, a physical mistake? How does it happen? If you had to copy something a billion times, would you make a mistake? Probably somewhere along the line. You know, because look, that's the way it is. So mistakes enter for various reasons, not just mutations. Sometimes there's copying errors. So that's a complex question, but there's a whole lot to it. And don't think it's a simple answer. In fact, if you want to read about it, you look up mutations and changes in genetic structure, and you'll spend the next 6 months. If you really dig in. All right. For those who are honest and see how the heavens and the complex organs point to an intelligent designer, and yet do not make God their Lord or obey him through his written word, what are some ways, or perhaps what approach do you use to guide them to the Bible, to Yahweh, to Jesus, and to obey the gospel? Good question. So can I give you a personal example? Met a young man in Romania many years ago, because we lived there for 2 years, who had been raised under communism. And he was taught from a child in his school system that not only is belief in God stupid, it's dangerous. And that in fact, as Karl Marx said in his writings, religion is the opiate of the people, and it's dangerous. So not only should you not believe in God because it's foolish, but if you do believe in God, you're going down a path that's dangerous for society. It's not good. That's the communist approach, if you're a pure communist, following the Marxian plan anyway. And so they were taught really to look down upon folks who were religious and even propose there were such a thing as God, because nobody believes that. That's foolishness. So I had the privilege of meeting up with him and spending 2 full days with him by myself talking about this kind of stuff. But this was the 90s, so some of this stuff wasn't available then. But he had never seen the evidence in the natural world that points to a designer. And frankly, he was overwhelmed by the evidence. He said, I've never seen any such thing. And so it was powerfully good. And he at least admitted that you have shown me that the natural world points to a reasonable belief in an intelligent designer. And from that, of course, I wanted to introduce him to the Bible, which is, I think, the order you should do it for a person who doesn't even believe in God. Let the natural world lead him to believe in God, and then say, don't you want to know more about him? And so we went to the Bible. He had to leave on the Merchant Marines, and I never saw him again. So I don't know what's happened with that young man, but I hope his eyes were open enough to go looking. But yes, you eventually have to take him to the Bible and to the story of Jesus. And why would he not want to believe such a wonderful story that shows how much God loves us in spite of the fact that we're sinful creatures and so far beneath him, we don't even deserve to be in his presence. So that's that. You're a freshman at a university in a science, sociology, psychology, or history class. Your professor denounces the existence of God, intelligent design, or the veracity of the Bible forcefully. As a believer, you recognize that this is influencing hundreds of students. How would you respond, and how do you recommend college students respond in front of their peers in this situation? So picture yourself in a seating auditorium of 300 students and the teacher's teaching chemistry, let's say. And he sets off on a tirade. I have been there. So what do you do? My opinion is you don't stand up and argue with the teacher in front of the class. You are going to lose. You don't stand a chance. Because the fact is, freshmen, you are ignorant. You don't know enough to be arguing with a professor. And you're going to lose. You're going to hurt the cause because you're going to say something you can't support, and he's going to tear you to shreds. I mean, that's my opinion. So what do? I think what you do is you try to do something privately. Influence those who you know and talk to them about evidence. It's important to point them to some of this good material. And I would say to you, if you can develop a relationship with that professor because you demonstrate you know what he's telling you and you're making A's in his class, that does help a little bit. For you then to go to him and say, "Sir, I'd like to talk to you respectfully about some of the things you said that, by the way, were not on your topic, but you kind of got involved in something that I'm sure you believe it, but I think you got off into a field that maybe is a little where it shouldn't be. And may I recommend to talk to you about some things? I'm not wise enough to do a good job with it, but I'd like to at least point you to some things. That's the best I know to do. Because I think you're not going to do something publicly and have much success. I'll tell you something else. Remember I told you about Dr. James Tour, teaches at Rice University. He's a nano engineer, and he's really a foremost authority and an openly avowed believer in Jesus. He's not a New Testament Christian as you and I would understand it, but he does believe in Jesus, and he bases it on the resurrection from the dead. If you were at Rice University, I'd get to know Dr. James Tour. And he tells his students, if you got a professor at Rice that starts attacking your religious convictions and especially about Jesus, please come to me and tell them to talk to me and we'll see how they do. So if there's somebody like that, find them and get help. And he does it in a kind way. So, all right. I've noticed that, as you've said, most of the changes in evolution that are pushed are biological, having to do with features and organs and not chemical, referring to the chemical processes underlying the biological ones. Are there any explanations for how these chemical processes, started by non-believers, or is that a sort of a deafening silence? Well, there are some efforts, but I must tell you, they're fairy tales. It's made-up stories. In terms of solid evidence for how that chemistry got to be the way it is, there's a lot of stories. But yes, you can dig in if you want to, and you can find people trying to explain how the chemistry of eyes evolved. There are some of those. Not very many. There are some. Okay, could a black hole in the universe be a connection with the human eye? I don't have a clue how to do with that one. So I choose to not it said some junk DNA produce RNAs that suppress expression of related genes. Since some diseases are caused by too many repeats of a gene, do you think it's likely that these junk DNA might be for the purpose of preventing or regulating diseases like that? That's a really interesting question. Because there's a whole set of information now from ENCODE that I talked to you about earlier that deals with diseases. So my recommendation to the person who wrote this question, if you really are interested, you go research ENCODE and ask for, in one of those three clicks you make, what the results were about disease, because it's fascinating. I know a little teeny bit. And I can tell you that one of the things they've discovered is there's stuff happening in the structure of your DNA that's not protein producing that definitely affects disease. You with me? It's not in that section that's producing proteins that are used for that. Other things that are happening in there that relate to the regulation that affect disease. There's no question about it. So if you want to dig in, that's where I'd start. And so you can go deeper. All right, let's see here. In the TED talk, it seemed that evolutionists were explaining how to build something that looks like an eye but doesn't explain how it would function. Do they offer more complex explanation, or is the simple diagram illustrated in the TED talk as far as they've gotten? No, there's more said than that. But it's not much better. It's basically Darwin's old argument from the 1800s, just dressed up. It's basically what it is. But you can search it further and you can find more information. So what is a gene? I just told you. That's a big old open question now. It's a pair of pants you wear. I'm not prepared to say much about that because this is brand new stuff. It's people still figuring this out. And so what is a woman? Reject God enough and you will be destroyed by lack of knowledge. When you question design, first you must understand that the purpose of the study of the designer to better understand the design. The design or the purpose is to better understand the design. That's not a question, I don't think. So what's a woman? Would you have believed, class, we'd ever come to a time in America where a Supreme Court potential justice is asked to define a woman and she says, I'm not a biologist. Would you have believed that? There's something fundamentally wrong there. I do a lesson on transgenderism and how the scripture relates to that. And folks, there's nothing clearer in scripture than that there are two genders that are based on the sexual properties of males and females. And that's it. Anything else is a figment of your mind. That's what the Bible teaches. What do you say to the argument that no matter how absurdly unlikely evolution is, anything is more convincing than a mystical God? And I would say to that, how mystical is it for you to say that something I've just described here happened by small-scale changes over millions of years without any guidance whatsoever? That is the ultimate mysticism. And we know factually that humans with their intelligence can make incredibly complex things. We know that. In fact, we know that the source of all language comes from an intelligent source. So why wouldn't you believe the same thing when you find a language in living things? So the mysticism goes both ways. Depends on your perspective. All right, folks, it's 12:15. It's been a good day. Thank you for your careful attention. And really, I was watching you. There were only a couple of you falling asleep. And that's pretty good. Thank you for your good attention. It's a joy to be with you, and I hope you've been stimulated by this to do your own thinking. Please, don't just take what I'm saying. Do your own thinking. And I hope you'll become stronger and stronger believers. Another thing I want to say to young people is, when I was in the 20s, not the teens and the 20s, I was really struggling with some of this because I was sitting at the feet of extremely intelligent people who were very convincing, didn't know how to answer this. So it's been the goal of my life to develop solid enough answers for myself to be able to help somebody else. And I will tell you, after 50 to 60 years of this in-depth study, I believe in God more strongly than ever, and so will you if you study it correctly and deeply. So don't you be afraid of the sciences. And God bless you in your study. And if I can help you in some way, I'm perfectly available. I'm retired. Doesn't mean I'm not busy, but I'll fit you in if you want to talk. And I can certainly direct you to places that'll help you. So that's it. And tomorrow morning at, 9:30? We're going to talk about the immune system, people. If you can all be here, you don't want to miss that. And if you do have to miss it, get the book called Immune. I meant to bring it with me and show it to you. It's about that thick. It's written by Detmer. He is not a scientist. He's a guy that wants to make complicated things simple. And so as one of his master's or doctor's degree projects, he took on the immune system. He thought it was going to be a one-semester project. It lasted 3 years. And he ended up publishing a book. And there's a website with all kinds of neat. I stole one of his videos and redid it a little bit and get the moderation off of there so I can do the moderation. He had a British guy moderating it. It was really neat. But he was totally evolutionary. And so is the book. But there's good stuff in it. And he's hilarious. He's a jokester. So we're going to laugh tomorrow morning. And we're going to look at some of the heavy things we've learned about the immune system. And by the way, in your generation, our, shall I say, the leaders of our health system in America have not given proper credit and respect to the natural immune system, in my opinion, which is better than anything man can do. And it's amazing. So tomorrow morning, and I'm done, Dan. What do you want to do?